This is The Law School Show. Discovering the person behind the resume. Bringing you their stories and their tips on how to succeed in your legal career. Catch it all here, right now, on The Law School Show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Law School Show. My name is Alim Esfahian. I'm very excited to be joined by Kara Zwiebel, who is the director of the Fundamental Freedoms Program at the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. So without further ado, I will pass it on to Kara. And yeah, Kara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So before we get started on the substantive content, which I mostly want to talk about vaccine passports and the new federal online harms bill, I was wondering if you can just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in the law.
Sure. So I am from Toronto. I'm not one of those people that always knew I would be a lawyer. My parents did tell me they thought I might want to go into the law because I liked to debate or argue. I guess I was always sort of interested in it as a possibility. I did my undergrad in political science at McGill. And then I did decide to apply to law school. I actually, at the same time as I was applying to law school, started to get a little nervous about it and a little unsure about it. So at the same time, I also applied to some culinary programs. I thought I might want to be a chef. But ultimately, when I got into law school, by then I think I had felt more comfortable and decided that that was something I wanted to do. So I went to Osgoode, and I'm someone who likes school in general and really liked law school also. And after law school, I clerked at the Supreme Court for my articles, and then worked for a while at a large firm. Then went to do my master's in the States at New York mm-hmm. University, and then came back and worked again at the firm for a little while, and then moved over to where I am now at the Canadian Civil Liberties Association.
Yeah, that's quite the range of experience. And I wanted to ask you about that because you clerked for Justice Binney, if I'm not mistaken.
And yes, that's right.
And then you went on to Big Law and then to CCLA. So that's just so diverse, the kind of experiences that you had. So how did you transition from one to the other, especially from Big Law to the CCLA?
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I guess I always, I never thought I would be at a large firm. I ended up working at a large firm in part because there was a lawyer at that firm who seemed like they would be a good mentor, and they were. And so I'm really grateful for the experience I had at that firm. But ultimately, I always really wanted to do constitutional law, to practice public law and constitutional law. And I did some pro bono work for the Canadian Civil Liberties Association while I was at the firm. And then when there was an opportunity there, I applied for it. I didn't actually get the job initially when I applied at the CCLA. But the new executive director at that time called me after and said, you know, we hired someone else, but when we have more money, we'd like to hire you. And I didn't know at the time whether that was just a very nice way of brushing me off. But in the end, a couple months later, they did call and say, we'd like to offer you the position now.
Oh, wow. So it was not necessarily through an application process. So after that, they just called you and said, we would like you to join.
Yeah, like they had an open posting that I applied for. So I had gone through that whole process already. And then, but they hired someone else. And then when there was another opportunity, they called me. So, and yeah, the transition was, it's a big adjustment because obviously at a large firm, you have a lot of resources, a lot of a lot of people around, a lot of support in terms of, you know, administrative support and things like that. And then you move to a small nonprofit where, like, it's not much of an exaggeration to say that on the first, my first day at CCLA, I think I was sort of like, oh, I think we have a computer you could use, and I think there's somewhere you can sit. And it was sort of that, that kind of vibe. It's definitely changed a lot since then. But it was, you know, a lot less formal and relied a lot more on me kind of making decisions about the work that I was going to do and where I was going to focus my time, and didn't involve docketing or clients. That was a big adjustment.
Yeah, docketing is something that I can say with confidence is not the favorite part of my law school journey. So in terms of constitutional litigation, can you provide our listeners with an overview of how it works, specifically how the CCLA gets involved? And just because there's so many different cases and so many different issues that you can work on, so what's the thought process that goes into, okay, we're going to work on this case as opposed to the other case?
Yeah, there's a lot of different factors that go into it, and cases come to us in different ways. So there's definitely cases that we, you know, the directors, the program directors of the organization are watching and, you know, decide we want to get involved. And generally, I mean, we have a board of directors that we will go to primarily if there's sort of a new area that we're looking at getting into, or where we are taking a position that is something, you know, we haven't considered as an organization before. A lot of cases, it's fairly obvious based on our, you know, past positions, what the position would be that we would take. And so we don't have to sort of constantly check in with the board about every decision. So there are some cases like that where we know we want to be there, and we go out and seek counsel, outside counsel to act for us. There are other cases where counsel come to us and say, you know, have you seen this case that just got leave at the Supreme Court, or have you seen this case that's working its way up? And I think CCLA should get involved, and I'd really like to represent CCLA. So we're really fortunate that we have lots of wonderful lawyers who want to work with us and want to do it for free. You know, and then sometimes, like at least as an intervener, sometimes the parties themselves will reach out to us and say, you know, this is a case where we think the CCLA might have something useful to add. But I'd say that's not the majority of cases. You know, the majority is either us sort of recognizing the case as important, or a lawyer bringing it to us. And then we do increasingly more now, you know, litigate ourselves. So we've initiated litigation in some cases, and that's a bit more complicated, and obviously a lot requires a lot more commitment from someone doing the pro bono work if they're going to be, you know, constructing a whole record and taking a case from start to finish. But we've again been really lucky to have wonderful lawyers do that for us in really important cases, like the, you know, challenge to solitary confinement, or the challenge to Bill 21 in Quebec that we have jointly with the National Council of Canadian Muslims. So so there's a bunch of different factors. And then there are some cases where we it may be a case where we're interested in getting involved and we decide not to just because of capacity issues. You know, there's just too much already going on, or there's a lot of other interveners. We don't necessarily have anything different or unique to say. The field is sort of covered. So sometimes we'll take a step back if we feel like the bases are covered.
So you briefly touched on this, but what would make the CCLA go to another firm for a particular case as opposed to litigating it internally within the CCLA?
I mean, for almost, you know, any case where we're intervening or initiating, I think more so on the initiating side, we almost always go to outside counsel just because we're small. I mean, there's the substantive programs, program staff at the CCLA. There's, you know, four program directors plus a director of education. And then the rest of the staff are either on the education or communications or fundraising or administrative side. And it's still not, even with all of those people, it's still not a very big group. So we just don't have the capacity internally to do all of those cases. And we also benefit from, you know, if it's a criminal law case with charter issues, then we want to get, you know, a lawyer with criminal law experience. And so, yeah, there's been, I think right now I might be the only lawyer at the CCLA who has represented us in court on some interventions. So I've done that periodically, and I enjoy it, but it's a much bigger time commitment. And when we have a lot of cases to manage, we rely on outside counsel.
So can you tell us about one of the cases that you litigated, and what aspect of it did you enjoy the most?
Sure. So one of the cases, the case that I probably worked on at CCLA for the longest was as counsel, was the Groya case, which was a case that went to, it did ultimately go to the Supreme Court, although we got involved in it at a very early stage. Groya was a case where a lawyer had been disciplined for something that he did in the course of representing a client in court. And there were concerns around freedom of expression and around lawyers' obligations to zealously defend their clients. And so after this lawyer was first subject to discipline by the Law Society, he appealed to the Law Society Appeal Tribunal. And that's when CCLA sought to intervene, and also the Advocate Society sought to intervene as well. And so I did that. You know, it was also a pretty low level of court. So, and I was less experienced, so it didn't seem like a bad idea to do it. But the case ultimately went to the Divisional Court, and then the Court of Appeal, and then the Supreme Court of Canada. I stayed with it throughout, throughout its trajectory. And ultimately, we got a pretty good result in the end. That was one of the cases I've done for us. I've done a couple of others, and they're all sort of in different areas, all areas that I'm interested in. And often I still, even though we don't have outside counsel, I might still go to someone on the outside and say, you know, can you take a look at this and tell me what you think?
So speaking of freedom of expression, if you don't mind, let's talk about the online harms bill. So can you just provide an overview of what it is and what it seeks to do?
Sure. So it's not yet a bill, although it looks a lot like it. So what the government did was shortly before calling the election, they released this proposal, there was a discussion paper and then a longer, more detailed kind of technical document that outlined a plan to tackle what they call online harms. And the basically the scheme it proposes is one that would deal with five different types of content online. And that's terrorist content or terrorist propaganda, hate speech, incitement to violence, child sexual exploitation material, and the non-consensual distribution of intimate images. And the scheme that they establish in this proposal is that they want basically social media platforms to have systems in place to really proactively kind of monitor and remove those types of content. They want them to have systems in place for people to complain about that content and for it to be removed very quickly if it's identified as that type of content within 24 hours. And then they want to create a whole sort of bureaucratic infrastructure where if you're ultimately not happy with what the platform does with that complaint, you can bring it to this other body. And there's also a body that would try and establish some codes of conduct and things like that. Some of the details around what these different bureaucratic bodies would do are a bit unclear. And in addition to that, there's also proposals that would have the platforms provide information to law enforcement agencies and to, in some cases, CSIS, Canada's spy agency, about some types of this, some of these types of content. Potentially, basic subscriber information about people that are sharing or uploading that kind of content. So there's a lot in there, and there's more. I mean, that's a very rough sort of outline. I think that the CCLA has made, we made relatively brief submissions as part of this consultation, partly because us, along with many others, were not very happy that the government sort of required us to engage in this consultation process while there was an election, and it was unclear whether they would actually, be the government. I think they introduced the proposal, and then, the election was held on the 20th of September, and then on the 25th of September, the submissions in relation to the consultation were due. And so if you were sort of waiting to see whether this government would prevail, you didn't end up having a lot of time in the end. So we made relatively brief submissions highlighting some of our concerns about, first of all, the consultation process, but also, really the idea that there's, I think, a couple of big flaws with the proposal. Mm-hmm. One is the idea that that the platforms can even do this kind of moderation at scale, given how much content gets, put online at any given moment. And so the desire to sort of try and proactively monitor what's being put out there and remove it very quickly is likely going to mean that the platforms have to do this with, artificial intelligence, with machines that are going to get things wrong, and that are probably, when you consider that, the penalties and fines for not taking down some of this content quickly are very large, it leads to a concern that platforms will over remove, right? They'll err on the side of caution and take stuff down, even if it's not clearly kind of illegal. And even there, I mean, the different categories of content that the government has identified are all things that are grounded in the law and are things that are, illegal in many circumstances. But it's not always very straightforward to determine whether a particular piece of content does fall on the kind of unlawful side of the line. So with hate speech, we have, a very narrow definition from the Supreme Court of Canada about what constitutes hate speech, and courts that look at content and have to decide whether something is hate speech often disagree with one another. So to ask, a platform moderator to make a decision within 24 hours, it's unrealistic and it's problematic.
Yeah, this is interesting to say the least, because right now, we're living in a discourse where people and policymakers are constantly talking about breaking up big tech and regulating big tech, which, of course, is something that is necessary. But this proposal really does seem to grant big tech more powers in taking down content on social media and enabling their monopoly and power as opposed to limiting it. So can you speak to that dynamic a little bit?
Yeah, there's a couple of different things. I mean, one is that some of the kind of regulatory obligations that are being imposed or proposed to be imposed on the platforms are things that really only the biggest of the big platforms could could realistically comply with. So in terms of trying to, encourage competition or encourage creators that are working on new types of platforms that have different models and maybe, you know, monetize things differently and maybe don't rely on the kind of data gathering that the big platforms do, it arguably creates disincentives to some of those things popping up. So that's a problem. There are some things in the proposal that I think generally are positive, like requiring some more transparency from the platforms about how they make decisions and how some of their algorithms work and things like that. But those also have a downside because in some cases, they actually would be asking the platforms to collect more information about individuals than they already collect. So, you know, if you want to know more about the demographics of your users, it's requiring the platforms to dig in more. I think that, generally, and I was talking to a group of people, civil society people who are all working on this issue earlier today, and I think a lot of people really feel that there's a lot that could be done in terms of regulating big tech that doesn't have to do with content, and that would be a much better place to start than to try and start with content. Because really, you're trying to control a universe of communications between people, you know, globally, and it's unwieldy and it's unrealistic. And I think to a certain extent, you just can't really do it. Even the large platforms that have, you know, so many resources get it wrong very often.
And I also wanted to get the position of the CCLA with respect to what is called lawful but awful content, where, you know, the question is not around whether a given post is necessarily illegal or not, but, you know, advocating for removing or blocking that content based on the fact that it may be or is harmful to other people who may be on social media. So I wanted to also get your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that, you know, the starting point is that if we're talking about expression and we're trying to basically justify censorship or, censorship of expression, we're going to want to have a clear legal grounding for that. So it makes me nervous that, you know, rather than talking about the unlawful content bill, we're talking about the online harms bill, because it does suggest that we are going to expand into areas that we think are harmful, but that we haven't seen fit to, you know, to either criminalize or render unlawful in some other way, in any other context. So I think that's concerning. And I think, you know, we want government to be specific and transparent about what it is they're trying to accomplish. There's also real problems with treating something like, you know, child sexual exploitation as a communications policy issue and not, you know, a public safety and law enforcement issue. And there, I think I've been generally underwhelmed with law enforcement responses to why this is such a difficult thing to tackle, and why, you know, why they feel they don't already have some of the tools that they would need to address that kind of content online.
Yeah, so just also looking at CCLA submissions, it seems that one of the major problems associated with this proposal is that it lumps together different categories of speech and gives the government a broad scope of powers to regulate content on social media. And in this respect, the proposal has been compared to many authoritarian regimes. So I was wondering what your thoughts are on the relationship of this proposal to other jurisdictions that have enacted online harms legislation? Does it fall more on the authoritarian side or on the more, democratic side?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's like, I'd say it's leaning more on that authoritarian side of the spectrum. I mean, it's, you know, the focus on takedowns, on potentially on website blocking, all of that is really unfortunate, for lack of a better word. And, you know, I think the government introduced this as in sort of in recognition of the fact that Canadians, and I think this is true, you know, believe that these platforms and that there is a lot online that does a lot of harm. And I don't disagree with that premise. I think the question is how you, how you try and solve that problem. And it's much more difficult than just identifying the problem. And so I think, and even frankly, the people that are supposed to be sort of protected by this law, you know, I think that the government did this, you know, hoping this would protect, you know, minorities that are being sort of silenced online because of the kind of abuse that they might face. Even those groups have generally said this isn't really how we want this done, because the problem with around regulating content is that you're going to get a lot of the good removed along with the bad. And and some of these platforms, so I don't use TikTok, and I don't know much about it, but I understand that there are these things you can do on TikTok where you sort of put videos like side by side, and it's sort of a responsive or like a dialogue type of thing. So you might have someone who's, you know, spewing kind of racist garbage in their video, and then you take that video and next to it you counter it, which is the great kind of, you know, model in terms of freedom of expression. But if you have an algorithm that's designed to remove that first video, it's also going to remove the video where that's being countered. And so there's a lot of problems with, with focusing so much on the content and not looking at some of the underlying issues.
Mm-hmm. And is there any particular reason why the Heritage Ministry is bringing this proposal forward?
Yeah, I think Heritage is generally where the CRTC legislation that deals with the Canadian Radio and Telecommunications Commission would live, and so it sort of, I think, treats the platforms as, you know, similar to like broadcast entities or media entities, and deals with that way. But it is strange because, you know, to see something in there that includes sharing data with CSIS, there's a bit of a disconnect. So so we'll have to see where that goes now that there's a new session of Parliament starting in about a month, I think. And I know that the government did say this was something that they wanted to make a priority. But we'll have to see, because they also did get in the consultation, I think, a lot of negative feedback from groups, including groups that I think they expected would be supportive. So lots of anti-racism groups feminist groups were, didn't see this as the solution that I think the government hoped they would.
And do you foresee that this proposal will become law as it currently stands, or do you think that some major changes are going to be brought about?
I don't know. I think that, you know, the reason I think we've been tripping over and calling it a bill is because the consultation document really does look like they had already written the bill and then they turned it into a consultation document. So, I would have expected that we'd see a bill that looks a lot like the proposal. There's been a cabinet shuffle. So the same minister who was in charge of heritage is no longer there. And maybe the consultation and the fact that there was quite a lot of pretty negative feedback will hopefully cause the government to think about whether this is the road they want to go down, or maybe engage in some more robust consultation with civil society and academia. I think there's a lot that could come from a really robust process like that.
Yeah, so let's move on to another hot topic, which is vaccine passports. And yeah, could you, it's pretty intuitive what it is, but can you just provide an overview and what you think to be the long-term concerns surrounding it in terms of civil liberties issues?
Sure. So, we've been talking about sort of vaccine passports or vaccine mandates, and they're different things, but they're sort of related. So we have a couple of different things sort of happening in Canada in different jurisdictions. One, which is what I think most people would think of as the sort of passport, is that in many places, you need to show proof of vaccination to access certain public spaces. So in Ontario, it's gyms and movie theaters and and generally that the jurisdictions in Canada that have done this have made it sort of relatively non-essential places. So places like restaurants and movie theaters where, you don't need to access that place in order to survive. It would be obviously nice to have access to those places, but they haven't generally been applied to grocery stores, drug stores, access to healthcare, and things like that. But so that's sort of one area. And then the mandate question comes in with places like post-secondary institutions, where many have policies that say students and faculty and staff must all be vaccinated and provide proof or an attestation. You also have it in the employment context. So at the federal level, the federal government has basically said every employee in the federal public service has to attest to their vaccination status. And then travel. So the federal government also announced that basically to board any plane or train in Canada, you will need to show proof of vaccination. I have yet to actually see the regulations on that particular one. I'm imagining that there are going to have to be exemptions. The example that immediately comes to mind is if the government decides they want to deport someone. My guess is that they're not going to not put that person on a plane just because they're not vaccinated. I think if they want someone out of the country, they will probably do that. Yeah. So I'm imagining that there'll be exceptions sort of built in, but I haven't seen the law. A lot of these things, we get the announcements and then it takes some time before we actually see a regulation or an order.
And what are some of the privacy concerns around the vaccine passports?
At the outset, I think we wanted to find out sort of exactly what information would be collected and could it be minimized and did it need to be kind of collected and stored, or could it just be something like, if you get asked if you order a drink and you get asked to show ID, you really just show it and, there's no recording of it. It doesn't go into a database. It's just something that is visually inspected. So that's less privacy invasive than potentially, scanning a code and having an electronic record created. So we wanted to know about those things. And we were raising concerns, particularly where more was being collected than was necessary. So in Ontario, when the requirement was first put in place, Ontario said, you'll either have to show your proof of vaccination or you'll have to show a medical exemption. And the medical exemption from a doctor or a nurse had to it couldn't just say that you were exempt from the vaccine. It actually had to give the medical reason why. That's personal information that seems excessive to provide to, you know, the maitre d' at the restaurant or the person who takes your ticket at the movie theater. It seems like information they frankly don't need. And so we, you know, we had concerns about that. There are other, in Quebec, I think their QR code system was created in a way that you got a QR code whether you had to share with the government if you had a medical exemption. I don't think you had to share with them why you had that medical exemption, but basically you got a QR code that either meant you were vaccinated or you had a medical exemption, and it didn't differentiate between those two things, which is a more privacy protective way of doing it than not.
Yeah. And what solution could there be to protecting public health on the one hand and respecting civil liberties, if not a vaccine passport? Or do you think that there's another version of a not necessarily a passport, but some sort of identification that can balance those two interests?
Yeah, I mean, so we haven't generally said this is, you know, unacceptable in every circumstance. We've raised questions and concerns about it in different circumstances. I think probably the least objectionable sort of context is the first one we talked about, the access to kind of these discretionary places where, you know, a restaurant or something like that. But I think the thing that we've been wanting to try to communicate is that because there's been a lot, because I think everyone is so, sick of being cooped up and anxious to try and get back to some sort of normal and anxious to avoid further, you know, lockdowns. And that's what this is. This has been sort of put to us as this is what we need to do to avoid further lockdowns. So the point that I think we've been trying to raise and to repeat is that this shouldn't just be something that we consider as no big deal. It is a big deal. It is a fundamental change in how our society works to say that you need to show some sort of credential to access basic public spaces. If it's an exceptional response to an exceptional crisis, then let's try to identify some of the ways in which we know that it's no longer necessary. So if this is supposed to be a temporary measure, how will the government decide when we don't need it anymore? Can we get some metrics about what that looks like? We haven't really gotten that. Although now, you know, I mean, the government of Ontario has made an announcement. They have a target date for when they're no longer going to use this. It's all very contingent. It's all, you know, as long as nothing else happens that we didn't expect to happen, which if the last, you know, almost like 20 months is any indication, probably something unexpected will happen. You know, BC also has sort of an end date, but it's all subject to, you know, there being no new variant, no new spike, you know, all sorts of things. So we've been trying to push governments to be more accountable on that front and more transparent about the measures that they're using. And just also recognizing, I think, again, because, you know, and I believe the vaccine is safe. I believe if you can take it, you should take it. You know, but the reality is that it's not just, I think it's easy to sort of assume that everyone who's refusing to be vaccinated is, you know, believes in some sort of conspiracy theory or has been brainwashed. But the truth is there are people who, you know, who have genuine fears. They have genuine reasons to distrust the medical establishment. And there are also people who, you know, even though our government has sort of said medically, basically anyone, the only reasons why you couldn't be vaccinated are if you have an allergy or if you had a reaction to a first dose. They've sort of identified those as the only kind of acceptable medical exemptions. But we know that there are people who have complex medical histories, and their physicians, who are not physicians that are handing out exemptions to everyone, but their physicians have said, I really don't think the vaccine is good for you. I really don't recommend it in your circumstances. And so I don't know what a person like that is supposed to do when, you know, a physician that they trust is telling them not to do this. And the government is telling them, if you don't do this, you know, you're basically going to be denied access to all of these spaces in society. So I think it's, you know, it's really difficult. I don't envy governments that they have to try and solve these problems. It's certainly much easier to point out the problems than to solve them. But I think we just have to, you know, continually be pushing the governments for answers to, you know, what is it exactly that you're trying to achieve? How does this achieve that? And what about some of the unintended consequences? What are we going to do to mitigate some of those?
Yeah, there definitely seems to be quite a bit of nuance that's not necessarily captured in public discussion, which really leads to my other question as to how to foster a dialogue that's nuanced, especially with policies like vaccine passports, which seem to be very popular in the eyes of the public, and even free speech issues, where I know that as a civil liberties organization, you have had to defend the right to speech for people who you don't necessarily agree with, and who the public view as heinous or hateful. So how do you handle, or how does the CCLA handle backlash that comes from these sorts of public opinion polls, or just, you know, unsolicited opinion emails, stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've, you know, we've been doing it for long enough. I think that we recognize that it's actually probably a sign that we're doing a good job if someone is angry at us and it's often different people that are angry at us for different things. So I think that means that, you know, we try to focus on the principles. We also try to make it clear that the principles are why we're there. So it's not about this particular comment that someone made that we agree with or disagree with. It's about the concern about what happens in society when we decide that certain views just can't be spoken. And so we, I think, try to consistently kind of stick to the principles and convey that in our communication. You know, I think we all internally at CCLA have some good discussions trying to sort of bat around the different perspectives that people might take on different issues. You know, and ultimately we recognize not everyone's going to be happy, and that's okay. And we also, you know, we have a role to play. We're not, ultimately we're not making policy decisions. We're trying to get the people that do make those decisions to think about some of the implications that maybe they don't think about as frequently as they should. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that that's the role that we can play and that we do play. And I think it's a valuable one. And even people who are, I've had some friends who are, you know, who have told me, I don't really agree with what you're doing, but I'm glad that there's someone there that's doing it. You know, they sort of recognize that, you know, you might be the person that's on the unpopular side of the next big debate. And you want there to be someone that's recognizing that you have the right to speak.
Yeah, it seems like CCLA is taking one for the team, team construed as a society. Thank you for that very insightful discussion. Just as a final question, I want to go back to your diverse range of experiences. And I was wondering if you have any advice for law students like myself, or, you know, professionals who are early in their career, as to how they can become effective lawyers, advocates, litigators, or policymakers. You know, because your experience is so diverse, I can just ask everyone.
I don't know. You know, I feel like I've been a lot of it is luck, and you know, a lot of opportunities are just being in the right place at the right time. I think you do have to make, you know, opportunities for yourself. So I, one of the ways that I sort of got a foot in the door at CCLA was when I was still at the firm that I was working at, there was a big party for Alan Borovoy, who was the general counsel of the CCLA for 40 years and was retiring. And I went with the firm, you know, the firm bought a table at that dinner and to celebrate that event. And I approached the new general counsel and sort of said, you know, I really like an opportunity to maybe work with you sometime. And so, you know, I do think you have to look for those opportunities, but a lot of it is, a lot of it just sort of happens. And I guess you have to get comfortable. I think you have to get comfortable with the fact that you can't control, you know, the outcome of everything, and you can't necessarily control the path of your career as particularly as you might want to. So I would just say to be open to, you know, different opportunities, even if there are things that you didn't think you wanted to do. If you think you can get something from it, you know, that you can learn from different people, or you can get a skill, even if it's not in the area of law that you want, you know, that there are good opportunities out there. And I know that I feel like students are always worried about getting sort of stuck, you know, but what if I start in this area, it's going to be very hard to transition. And I think that that's true to a point, but, you know, spending a year somewhere or 2 years somewhere is probably not going to pigeonhole you. And probably you're going to get a lot of skills that you can transfer to different areas. Yeah.
Yeah. The good thing about law is that it's very, the skills that you gain are very transferable. So it does offer you quite a bit of flexibility. Yeah. And with that note, just want to say thank you again for joining us. And yeah, I look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
You've just been listening to The Law School Show. You can find more episodes on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and now on Spotify, or on our website at thelawschoolshow.com. If you liked what you heard, like us again on Facebook or follow us on Twitter for the latest updates. Human stories, new legal topics, and career advancing advice right to your earbuds. Catch it all here. Next time on The Law School Show.